A Rose for Emily. The end of part 4 and part 5. The front door closed upon the last one and remained closed for good. When the town got free postal delivery, Miss Emily alone refused to let them fasten the metal numbers above her door and attach a mailbox to it. She would not listen to them. Daily, monthly, yearly, we watched the Negro grow grayer and more stooped, going in and out with the market basket. Each December, we sent her a tax notice, which would be returned by the post office a week later, unclaimed. Now and then, we would see her in one of the downstairs windows. She had evidently shut up the top floor of the house, like the carven torso of an idol in a niche, looking or not looking at us, we could never tell which. Thus she passed from generation to generation, dear, inescapable, impervious, tranquil, and perverse. And so she died, fell ill in the house, filled with dust and shadows, with only a doddering Negro man to wait on her. We did not even know she was sick. We had long since given up trying to get any information from the Negro. He talked to no one, probably not even to her, for his voice had grown harsh and rusty as if from disuse. She died in one of the downstairs rooms, in a heavy walnut bed with a curtain, her gray head propped on a pillow, yellow and moldy with age and lack of sunlight. Part 5. The Negro met the first of the ladies at the front door and let them in, with their hushed, sibilant voices and their quick, curious glances, and then he disappeared. He walked right through the house and out the back and was not seen again. The two female cousins came at once. They held the funeral on the second day, with the town coming to look at Miss Emily beneath a mass of bought flowers, with the crayon face of her father musing profoundly above the bier, and the ladies sibilant and macabre. And the very old men, some in their brushed Confederate uniforms, on the porch and the lawn, talking of Miss Emily as if she had been a contemporary of theirs, believing that they had danced with her and courted her, perhaps, confusing time with its mathematical progression as the old do, to whom all the past is not a diminishing road, but instead a huge meadow, which no winter ever quite touches, divided from them now by the narrow bottleneck of the most recent decade of years. Already we knew that there was one room in that region above stairs which no one had seen in 40 years, and would have to be forced. They waited until Miss Emily was decently in the ground before they opened it. The violence of breaking down the door seemed to fill this room with pervading dust, a thin, acrid pall, as of the tomb, seemed to lie everywhere upon this room, decked and furnished as for a bridal. Upon the valance curtains of faded rose color, upon the rose-shaded lights, upon the dressing table, upon the delicate array of crystal and the man's toilet things backed with tarnished silver, silver so tarnished that the monogram was obscured. Among them lay a collar and tie, as if they had just been removed, which, lifted, left upon the surface a pale crescent in the dust. Upon a chair hung the suit, carefully folded. Beneath it, the two mute shoes and the discarded socks. The man himself lay in the bed. For a long while, we just stood there, looking down at the profound and fleshless grin. The body had apparently once lain in the attitude of an embrace, but now the long sleep that outlasts love, that conquers even the grimace of love, had cuckolded him. What was left of him, rotted beneath what was left of it, the nightshirt, had become inextricable from the bed in which he lay. And upon him, and upon the pillow beside him, lay that even coating of the patient and biting dust. Then we noticed that in the second pillow was the indentation of a head. One of us lifted something from it, and leaning forward, that faint and invisible dust, dry and acrid in the nostrils, we saw a long strand of iron gray hair.